You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. When we think of stories and encounters involving vampires, werewolves and the living dead, we would most of the time presume that these originated from Europe. Yet, author and researcher John LeMay has uncovered hundreds of accounts of strange encounters all across the United States in his Cowboys And series of books over the last 10 years. In his latest book, Cowboys and Monsters, John covers all kinds of historical accounts where people had encounters with all manner of strange creatures. There's also encounters with dinosaurs on both land and in the air, and the incredible and heartbreaking story of the Navajo witch trials. But before we join John, don't forget, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon. You can click the link in the show notes or go to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you early access, bonus content, ad-free episodes, and more. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. It's time to saddle up and join John LeMay as we head out on the hunt for all kinds of strange monsters.
On today's show, I'm delighted to welcome an author whose work I have admired for quite a while. With a deep love of stories of the Old West, monster movies, and his fantastic series uncovering strange cowboy encounters, John LeMay is a man with many similar passions to myself. In his latest collection, Cowboys and Monsters, Vampires, Mummies, and Werewolves of the Wild West, John has found some highly unusual newspaper articles from the past. John, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
Paul, I'm honored to be here, and I think this is the first time I've ever done a show across the Atlantic.
Really?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I am both surprised and delighted then, John, to welcome you to the UK airwaves. When I speak to people that I've known for a while as a reader of these wonderful books that come out of the US for people like us here in the UK, John, you are somebody that, as I said in the introduction, I've admired for quite a while because I love weird historical stories. And I think yourself and Noah Torres, who have done these amazing collections over the last decade, really have sort of created this niche that I think a lot of people just wouldn't be aware of.
Yeah, and you said it yourself, 10 years is when it started. I can't believe it. It was back in 2011. That movie Cowboys and Aliens was about to come out with Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford. And, you know, I knew from Noe, and I'm glad you know who that is. So Noe Torres, for anyone listening, he's a UFOologist or ufologist from Edinburgh, Texas. And I knew that Noe would know all of these cool Old West UFO stories like the Aurora UFO crash. So I called Noe up and said, why don't we do the real Cowboys and Aliens, because you know so much about it. And we'll cobble together this book kind of to tie in with the movie. And so we actually, by some miracle, managed to crank it out. And then oddly enough, we didn't do another one for about 9 or 10 years. And we both just got the bug again one day and started cranking them out again. So now we've done quite a few.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting as well, because it's a book that I've been aware of for quite a long time. So I was one of those people thinking, well, where's the rest of them? Because they can't just be these. So I think when you look at this particular subject, often people tend to look back to the sort of stories of the Wild West and 19th century America and just didn't really appreciate or perhaps comprehend that there were so many stories out there.
Yes, and what it is, partly too, the big gap in the books was due to technological advancements. So back in 2011, newspaper.com and newspaperarchive.com, I don't know if they existed or were just in their infancy, but you know, to me back then, it was still kind of the days of microfiche readers and things like that. So Noe and I, you know, mostly were relying on what people like Jerome Clark had already discovered. He's probably the real pioneer in terms of finding the old stuff and bringing it to light. But with newspaper.com, it's so easy to just search airship. Yeah, they didn't have the term UFO back then, but you know, you'd search airship or from another world or whatever their kind of terminology was. And it's kind of like you go fishing and see what you find. And actually, I would liken it to panning for gold, because you sift through a lot of dirt. You know, a lot of them you can tell are just hoaxes, or they're not what you thought they were. But then every once in a while, you get that piece of gold and you'll find this really cool story that nobody's ever unearthed or rediscovered before. And it's such a fun feeling.
Absolutely. I mean, for yourself, John, as someone who has been born and bred in Roswell, your family have grown up there as well. You are a man who is extremely proud of the part of the world that you inhabit. You love your town. I've heard you speak passionately about living in Roswell. And I think for a lot of people, it would be quite surprising that you've developed such a real thirst for archive diving and looking into these historical records. Because as you say, as technology's developed and it's given us all a wider palette of being able to look back into the history, when you sort of in a small town, in those days, you're kind of restricted by your local library or your local archive.
That's right. And way back in 2009, I wrote a book called Roswell, USA. And that's the only time I can honestly say I went to the library and went through microfiche. And I just basically went through the old Roswell Daily Records from between like 47 to 1950s to just see what other UFO stories were published in there that maybe people forgot about. And I only found like one or two. They weren't terribly interesting, but yeah, that was the only time I did microfiche. And then I am an archivist at the Roswell Historical Museum as well, and I do occasionally deal with, like, production companies will want a picture of old time Roswell because they're doing a documentary on the UFO crash or what have you. So yeah, I have learned to enjoy archiving quite a bit.
So where's this passion come from, John? Because I think when people, and I would imagine quite disrespectfully, think about towns like Roswell and New Mexico, they're not probably the kind of places that people would think are particularly historic. Obviously, as we were saying before we started our conversation properly, a lot of people know Roswell purely for the UFO incident in 1947 and everything else that went around it. But Roswell is a town that has a long history tied into some deeply famous names and notorious characters throughout history, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, you said yourself you enjoyed Westerns about, you know, the America's, you know, pioneer days with the cowboys and all that. And so for people, let's say, across the Atlantic, I guess where I would start is the movie Young Guns with Emilio Estevez, mm-hmm. or maybe the movie Chisholm with John Wayne. Those are all based on things that really happened in my neck of the woods, because Roswell is about 50 miles from the town of Lincoln, where the Lincoln County War occurred. Billy the Kid shot it up and all that. Mm. And the main reason Roswell isn't as famous as Lincoln, kind of ironic, is back in the old days, Roswell was the neutral zone in the Lincoln County War where everyone got their mail. And the postmaster said, if you guys fight each other here, I'm just going to pack up and leave and nobody gets their mail, which was good back then. But today, you know, if Roswell had had a big fight here, you know, it would just be another thing to promote through tourism. Mm. But yeah, so we're in that area, and John Chisholm lived here, which is who John Wayne played in the movie Chisholm. So we're home to a lot of legendary Western figures, believe it or not. It's just that since the 1980s on up, the UFO has really eclipsed that.
Mm. When you look at Roswell, do you think it's tied to these characters from the Wild West or the Old West or the Pioneer Days, whatever term you want to label it, John? Do you think it's because of its proximity to the border that a lot of people who had the law on their tails were kind of passing through on their way to the border to get out of the way for a bit?
That's a good way to think about it. You know, we're not horribly far from, you know, El Paso and all that in the scheme of things and the border. So that could be, although I think just in the West in general, it was so uncivilized. It just drew those types of people.
Yeah, absolutely. So where did your love of archivism come from? Because I know you were a young man who loved to write. You kind of put your passion down to having the kind of college teacher a lot of people wish we all had at that period that really encouraged us. Because I know you had a real sort of boost to your passions when you did a writing project, I believe, at college about lost dinosaurs.
Yeah, you have a really good memory. So to go way, way back, when I was a little boy, I liked to read Daniel Cohen's books on, you know, cryptozoology and monsters. Mm. Those were my favorites.
Yeah.
And so as an adult, you know, as a kid, I kind of wanted to emulate that and do something similar. And I, you know how you are when you go through your teen years, you forget. But as you said, when I was in my college writing course, our teacher let us pick our research subject, which they never did in high school. You know, they picked your subject for you.
Yeah.
But when she said I could do anything I wanted, I thought, well, you know, I'll go back to those remnant dinosaurs. They've always interested me so much. And and I just had such a blast writing that report. And it kind of made me realize, well, maybe I could do a book. It was still a long ways off at that point, but it just made me realize that I how much I enjoyed it. You know, basically. So, yeah, her name's Kate Davis, and she's actually from Britain.
Oh, is she?
Yeah, she is.
And I think, do you think it was the fact that you had so much fun doing that project and you got such a good grade that you thought, yeah, I really enjoy doing this. This could really lead to something down the line.
Absolutely. But ironically enough, though, my first writing endeavor was a novel, and I've only just now published it this year. And I'll talk about it at the end of the show. But I started working on that novel, and then I ended up getting an opportunity, though, to do a nonfiction title for Arcadia and the History Press. I mean, they even extend, I think, into Britain and Europe and everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they wanted the Roswell book, and I managed to nab that, and that led me to the Historical Museum, and then that led me into the archives. And, you know, I was just there to write my book. But as I was there, I kind of learned how to do things. And so then I became a volunteer and, you know, just kind of snowballed from there.
So obviously when you were sort of delving into the archives, John, was there a particular story or newspaper report that you saw that kind of lit a fire under you in regards to thinking, what on earth is this story talking about, you know, some kind of weird encounter or a pioneer or a rancher seeing something strange in the sky? Was there a particular story that you first stumbled across that made you think, bloody hell, what is going on here?
You know, not really in our Roswell archive, at least not initially. The weirdest thing I found in our Roswell archive was a rancher in a nearby settlement shot at a goat man in 1937. You know, goat man, they're pretty common the world over, but not really here in New Mexico. And the only really cool thing we have in there that I would suggest for like a ufologist from out of town is we have a whole newspaper file of clippings on meteors. But even though it says meteors, the file is really mostly the green fireball phenomena of the late 1940s, and it's UFOs of the 1950s. So the title of that file is kind of misleading. It's really all about UFOs, and that you could probably make a book from that. And I would if I had time. I've just got so many other projects I'm not even going to try right now. But yeah, so there is cool stuff in there. But most of the neat stuff I find is just through newspaperarchive.com. That's the site I really like.
Mm. What I really enjoy about your work is that you're able to pull these collections together. And as you referred to about the film Cowboys and Aliens, when I've looked at other books, as you refer to, in regards to the collections of these stories about strange lights being seen, the whole airship flap that seemed to occur all across the United States, John, towards the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century is something I think, as you mentioned when we were starting the chat, a lot of them are, you know, made up by editors, and a lot of these stories were kind of had some space to fill. But I think eventually you start to get to a point where you think, well, some of these stories really do have some credence. And it's, I think, a very strange aspect of that period of time that these reports seem to come from all over the US.
Yeah, so my argument that I use on more skeptical people, and it stands whether it's remnant dinosaurs or Bigfoot or even vampires or whatever, is, you know, when you've got people way, way back in the old days who were so isolated by time and space, you know, across the continents, they couldn't really communicate with each other or steal ideas from each other is what I really mean. And all of these people all have their same legends about the creatures that look like dinosaurs or the beings that came from the sky or the beings that drank blood. You know, they all have them across the world. And, you know, so to me, it's like, well, what are the odds they saw them in ancient times, or you can find them on cave art, and then we see them today? Why is it so weird that, you know, they would occasionally at least have these sightings back in the pioneer period and they'd put them in newspapers? And of course, you know, there was yellow journalism in terms of entertainment, just pure entertainment, was a lot worse back in those days. They would just make a fictional story and they would never, ever run a disclaimer that it was made up, and they just put it in there with the real story. So it's really frustrating for us today trying to figure out which ones were real and which ones were obviously fake. So it's tough.
Yeah. I think it's a very fair point though, John, because obviously I know enough about that period of American history to know that a lot of places were hundreds of miles apart. And if you've got stories about strange things in the sky in Montana, and also strange things in the sky in New Mexico in the 19th century, they're not going to be ripping each other off. These people will probably have never met. They probably didn't have any way to get to each other at all back in those days, John, because obviously this is the era before the train carved itself across the continent. So I've always found that point really valid, because the US is such a big place. Even when you look at, you know, as I've mentioned on a few previous shows, I think there are 7 states the whole of the UK can fit inside of in America. So that shows you how big it is. So for somebody to kind of dismiss it, like you say, about, you know, cross-pollination or people just stealing ideas from different cities and different towns, it doesn't stand up when you look at the evidence of how people could travel even.
Yes, and also another thing too, this is especially good with dinosaur sightings. I guess kind of how you spot a hoax with the dinosaur sightings is if the writer of the article attributed traits to the dinosaur that were unique to that era, that being mostly that in the early 1900s, they thought that dinosaurs stood around like Godzilla with their tail on the ground upright, or kind of like a kangaroo. So whenever you see a dinosaur report like that, it's, you know, it raises your suspicions. But on the other side, if you read an old newspaper account where the dinosaur is leaning forwards and the tail is in line with the body, like they think it would have been, you know, today that's how they think they stood and they ran. So if you see an article like that from the 1800s where someone saw this thing and that's how it ran and it stood, that makes you think that, well, maybe that one was one of the real ones.
Yeah. I've always been fascinated by this trend in regards to people coming across encounters with pterosaurs, John. And anybody that's got a love of cryptozoology probably has this memory that it seems that for a lot of writers and researchers in the field of cryptozoology, we all seem to think that we've seen this famous photo of this pterodactyl nailed to a barn taken somewhere in America in the 1860s or something, John. And yet people go, oh, well, it's just a one-off. And yet when you start to look at this, these kind of stories were reported all over, especially in the southern US states, it seems, that a lot of people were seeing giant lizards that flew in the sky.
Yes, and someone, I don't know if it was probably our mutual friend, Dr. Shuker, Carl Shuker. I don't know if it was him or maybe Carl just shared the article, but someone recently found a third article detailing the Tombstone Thunderbird of 1890. Because, you know, they always had, you know, there was always the story from 1890 from the Tombstone epitaph. Then there was the story of the Lake Elizabeth dragon in California from the same time, and they said it flew off in an eastward direction. You know, so those were the original two, but someone else, they found an article from the same time period where it was between Tombstone and Lake Elizabeth, California, where a pterodactyl was seen. And it's like the dates line up perfectly. So it's like either some newspaper writer was making this up perfectly and passing it along to his buddy in another state or something. But I think what's more likely is there just really was a pterodactyl that, you know, flew around during that time period. You know, I mean, it's almost more of a strain to believe it was some orchestrated hoax, you know.
It is. And as well, because often in those days, some of these collections and weird stories that newspapers printed were often quite silly, really, some of them. And I've seen many a newspaper article from the States in the 19th and early 20th century, John, where they're talking about all kinds of strange creatures that clearly are just made up. And obviously, some of the northern states are famous for their monster hoaxes that they created during the lumberjack era, especially. And so these dinosaur encounters, as you say, were you surprised when you started to come across so many? Because I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that when people were moving into the areas at that period, it was a completely alien world to them. A lot of them had sort of come in from the East Coast and were slowly drifting westwards. So for a lot of people, they were probably finding themselves in an environment that was totally alien to them.
Yes. So to answer that question, you know, as I said, in 2011 is when Noe and I did The Real Cowboys and Aliens. And then I had for years and years wanted to do a kind of a sequel of just the cowboys and the dinosaurs. Mm. And I finally got around to it in 2019. And I thought, you know, I'll get the Tombstone Thunderbird. There's that, the Ceratosaurus from the Arctic was another one I knew about, and a few others. I thought, you know, I bet I can eke together maybe like a 120 page book at least. And wow, once I went down the rabbit hole, I've just discovered so many stories that I realized that it would have to be split into another book, and then that book got split into another book. So, I mean, I really think that in terms of these cowboys and saurians books, I can probably do about 10 of them before it's all said and done, because I have articles stashed away for the future kind of by subject. You know, like I have one, they're all from the ones from Australia, you know, so I'll do an Australian version and so on.
Yeah. I mean, that is another place, I think, for any sort of cultural reference. It is, for me, quite peculiar that you've got a lot of these stories from the US and quite a few from the outback in Australia, which on face value, you would say that some of these areas are quite similar in their environment and the temperatures that are available and the landscape sometimes, John. So it's not beyond the realms of comprehension that something strange could have been lurking back in those days.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't plan to go the world over with the Cowboys and Saurian series, but it was just with Australia. It's the one place overseas that to me is kind of like the Wild West, because they have the jackaroos instead of the cowboys. And then the Aboriginals, you know, kind of have the advanced knowledge of the different dinosaurs and monsters that roam the outback. And they talk about the dreams time and all that. So, yeah, so I just thought the Cowboys and Dinosaurs Down Under was a must, because it's so similar to the Wild West.
Was there any particular trends that you came across when you were diving into these dinosaur encounters? Were there more particular types of one creature being reported at certain periods, or often was it a wide variety of creatures that were being reported, more than just, as we were saying, about strange flying lizards and other such creatures?
You know, that was what got me in a good way, is those old reports really lined up with our modern reports, because in terms of modern times, I feel like what we mostly have are pterosaur sightings in the air, mm-hmm. or some sort of plesiosaur aquatic reptile in the water. You know, the what do you call them? The theropod bipedal dinosaurs. They're really pretty rare. But, you know, so, and it was same back then. I don't think I ever came across any articles about like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. I came across one that was had to be a hoax. And then the Ceratosaurus of the Arctic Circle actually has a lot going for it and going against it. So it's a really confusing one too. But yeah, mostly it's just pterosaurs and plesiosaurs, which lines up with what we have today. So I found that encouraging.
Mm. I think as a child, one of my favorite films is the Valley of the Gwangi, which is obviously a famous film for anybody who loves monster movies and westerns, because it's an amalgamation of a dinosaur being captured by a group of cowboys. Is it not, John?
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that obviously, yeah, that was an inspiration for me in the book. But what really shocked me, for people who remember Valley of Guanju well, it kicks off not with a dinosaur, but with the discovery of a little miniature prehistoric horse.
Mm.
And it's so strange, in real life, in, I don't remember the time period, they had sightings of miniature horses in the Grand Canyon area, and they theorized that there was this plateau somewhere in the Grand Canyon that was kind of cut off from the rest of the world, where prehistoric creatures still roamed. And I really actually would hazard to guess that Willis O'Brien, you know, the old animator behind King Kong, I really think he probably heard those stories and the Tombstone Thunderbird and all that, because he was the one who actually pitched the Valley of Guanji, and he just never got it off the ground, and it didn't get made until after O'Brien had passed away by Ray Harryhausen. Mm-hmm. So I think O'Brien based his idea on real things, and he was definitely enchanted with the cowboys and the Southwest and all that.
Yeah, it would be very interesting when you look at that period of when that film came out. Clearly, somebody involved in that had stumbled across one of these stories, and perhaps one of those times where you bump into people who are, you know, in the mid 30s or whatever, John, whether they're sort of 70s or, you know, in their 70s or 80s, and they will say, oh, well, these stories about strange dinosaurs lurking outside in the Badlands and places like that, and some of these far-flung remote areas all across that area of the US, that perhaps those stories were always sort of ingrained in popular culture in certain places, and it's just developed and became the film that we know now.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when you look at that, are you surprised that there haven't been more films of that ilk? Because clearly there's a rich vein of these encounters from that period, John, that it's, for me, as a lover of monster movies, both good and bad, as I suspect you are, that there aren't many sort of similar films, which is quite odd, because there are many, you know, many films about strange creatures coming out of the sea and giant octopuses and weird hairy creatures running all over the place around the world. And yet these remnant dinosaurs lurking about, as we were saying earlier, tend to be focused on late monsters more than sort of dinosaurs.
Yeah. So, I mean, with Valley of Guanji, as so they're not being similar films, I think that movie just came out at the wrong time. It probably just opened in the wrong window and wasn't a hit. Whereas if it had opened, who knows, a few months earlier, a year earlier, a few years later, whatever, it might have done a lot better and there would have been similar films. But yeah, it was actually a big failure. And I guess that's why there weren't any more like cowboy and dinosaur movies. And even Cowboys and Aliens wasn't that big of a hit. It did okay, but I think they kind of viewed it as a disappointment overall. So there's definitely a fascination with the idea of the Weird West, but those movies just tend to never do well. It's very strange.
It is. I mean, I've recently seen the new series on Prime, which is Outer Range, which essentially is probably the first attempt, I think, of somebody doing a weird Wild West type show. John, I'm not sure if you've seen it, but that's all very sort of strange things going on and a time portal being discovered in the ground. And there's a lot going on. And clearly it's one of those series that I think they're looking to sort of develop it over two or three seasons, because by the end of the first season, you kind of get this sort of moment at it when you realize what the ending means in regards to everything you've seen in the previous episode. So there's clearly a passion for that kind of subject. But like you say, I think it is often, unfortunately, timing that kills off certain genres. Maybe they're ahead of their time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and I think Outer Range, it wasn't based on a Louis L'Amour book, but Louis L'Amour had a similar idea he called The Haunted Mesa, which is coincidentally like his worst received book ever. It's like the bottom of all of them that I can tell. So it was just another one of those that didn't quite make it. But Outer Range, you know, it's based on not necessarily true stories like with that one family, but I have a feeling that it was probably based pretty heavily on Skinwalker Ranch, and they just did throw in the UFOs and the Skinwalkers and all that because it's kind of similar.
Mm. I've seen somebody say that they think it's based on the famous Mel's Hole story from the Art Bell radio show, John. But I know enough about strange West sort of ideas that I think there's more to do with it, as you say, than anything to do with that. Because other than it being a giant hole, I don't think there's much comparison.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually never heard of Mel's Hole, so I'm going to have to look that up later.
Oh, it's a fabulous story. But that for me, John, I think that's as far as it went. It's quite funny, actually. It's a bit weird. But yeah, it's all a bit strange. And it ends rather quickly as well. It seems to explode and then he's moved to Australia. It's a very strange tale, even now, 26 years on from it being broadcast at the time. So when you're developing these stories, like you were saying about finding these clippings and beginning to store them, is it sometimes, as you were saying about the amount of dinosaur and saurian encounters that you came across, is it sometimes where you're like, I don't know what to do with all these? And that's why it suddenly developed far quicker and into more books than you perhaps realized at first attempt.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I did my best to categorize them. Like my first subset was Ice Age animals that were, you know, mammals or things like that, which, you know, developed into that second book, Cowboys and Saurians, Ice Age. And then, yeah, I kept coming across a lot of stories from the deep South. And I thought, well, you know, the South isn't really like cowboys in the West. It's its own thing. So that became Southerners and Saurians. And then next was South America and Mexico. Found a lot of those. And as I said, I'll do one in Australia. I've got one devoted just to the giant snake stories. There's so many of those. And then I've got some that are just kind of a hodgepodge, I might call like the lost cases or something. But it actually happened again with my Cowboys and Monsters book I just did. So what you see in that book is actually just the best of the best and the most Western type stories.
Mm.
But, you know, when we were talking before the show, you mentioned like Exeter, Rhode Island, which I wrote about initially. For Cowboys and Monsters, but then I took it out and I thought, you know, I'm going to do a book that's just cowboys and vampires and just put all the vampire stories into one book. And I'm going to do one that's just all the cowboys and werewolves and then all of the mummy stories. So there's going to be three more books, you know, after this Cowboys and Monsters that just came out that just focus on each. But Cowboys and Monsters is kind of like the best of the best and the most Western Southwest type. But so there'll be three more at least.
Mm. I was really surprised with the latest book for several things. There are a couple of things I've never heard of, John, which I'd like to pick your brains about in a moment. But obviously the first story that you cover is this vampire on the rampage in South Dakota. And when I've read your book, as we were saying about these vampire stories that were more established in the north of the US in the 19th century, I was taken aback because there's three or four vampire stories, including a very odd one about a chair, John.
Yeah.
So where is it something that as a lover of these weird stories and as an archivist and as someone that's been immersed in this strange subject for the best part of a decade, were you surprised that there were this many vampire stories there? Or was it that kind of thing that once you've peeled back the weirdness, nothing would surprise you anymore?
No, I was still surprised at the amount of vampire stories because, you know, I knew by now that there was alien and UFO stories, but I thought, that's probably not true of vampires too, you know. But it was, so, you know, quite a few. And I always like to give credit where credit's due. I don't think I've unearthed any or rediscovered any vampire stories. And this particular Cowboys and Monsters book, I know all of those I got from other people. It seems like Brent Swanser, he's a really great paranormal writer. I think he's the one that introduced me to like Count Saint Germain and some of the other ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite characters. There aren't many places he hasn't turned up, John, Count Saint Germain.
Wow. Yeah.
Sure, there's a story about him turning up on Mount Shasta at one point as well.
Yeah, that's just so... And it's funny to me that Count Saint Germain, for anyone listening, you know, he's an alleged vampire. It's funny to me that he met the Italian mystic Cagliostro, or however you say it, Because Cagliostro is the real life inspiration for Universal's Mummy movies. So mm-hmm. to me, it's funny. You've kind of got like a real life Dracula and a real life mummy that met each other at one point.
It is. I mean, Saint Germain is a very odd character because he's clearly somebody that was quite important historically here in Europe because he had operas performed in London. So he is a real person, John.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting legend or collection of stories, however you want to look at it, because I know there's a brilliant show called Unexplained, a podcast by a gentleman called Richard McLean Smith, and he did an episode of where he focuses on different stories from around the world. He's done it for 6 or 7 years now. He did an episode on Saint Germain, and it's one of the few episodes that really scared my partner, because it's this concept of an immortal, as many people say, that he's possibly a vampire, who had this kind of ability to sort of glide through a century in Europe and still have this alleged knowledge of people he met when they were children being sort of really old people. It's a fascinating tale.
I'm not even embarrassed to say that I've kind of come to believe that story. That's one that there's a lot to back it up.
It is. And like I say, when I found out that he'd had operas produced and he was a real, because I'd always thought he was just one of those tales that's been spun for many a year, John, and I remember seeing an episode of In Search Of that covered it, and I know he's been on many other sort of mysterious programs over the years on all many a network and many a paranormal show. So then to discover that he's actually got a footprint in history that proves he was real really makes you start to scratch your head and think, what is going on here with this character?
Well, what really intrigued me is the filmmaker Ken Russell had an unmade version of Dracula he was going to do. And his take on Dracula was this. It was that Dracula was an artist, like kind of like Saint Germain. And every few years he would reinvent himself with a new name. And it's really identical to the Saint Germain story. So I have to wonder if Ken Russell knew about that. And that's where he got his take on Dracula.
Mm. Yeah, that would be interesting. I remember seeing, strangely enough, I recently rewatched Kolchak, The Night Stalker, and that was a very similar sort of story about this person that turns up somewhere for 10 years, does stuff, and then dies, and then turns up 500 miles away, and the same thing starts over and over again. And one of the first things I thought, exactly the same as you referred to there, John, was it had some parallels with Saint Germain and Dracula.
Yeah, and well, I'm not going to go real deep down a conspiracy theory rabbit hole, but there are those that say that people in Hollywood know the real truth and the underbelly of the supernatural. So I do wonder sometimes if that's true and that's how they know these things.
So when you're looking at these vampire stories, the one in South Dakota is quite peculiar. And I know you look at some other aspects of this. I mean, I was just astounded when I was reading these stories about mummies, even. That's one of those subjects that I think often when you say the word mummy, immediately most people think Egypt. But there are so many cultures around the world that also follow the process of mummification that I think the term has been overused to primarily focus on one particular culture.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So the mummies really surprised me too. You know, for anyone listening, unfortunately, there's no stories about mummies coming to life or anything like that, but there were mummies of famous figures from the U.S. history in the West. The most famous is John Wilkes Booth, allegedly was not killed. He got away. And John Wilkes Booth, according to this story, didn't die until like the early 1900s, and he committed suicide by drinking arsenic. And so when the embalmer did his thing on the body, when his embalming fluids combined with the arsenic, it mummified this man who claimed he was John Wilkes Booth. And then someone else exploited that. And they made him into the John Wilkes Booth mummy and toured him across America. And then the most interesting part was they started to say that the mummy was cursed and it caused a train wreck that all these freak circus animals were on. And to me, that's the most far out interesting part of the story, but it did happen. So yeah. So there's a lot of Old West mummies.
I'm very surprised about this. This seems to have been a real sort of sideshow attraction in that era, because there are numerous characters from American history and plenty of outlaws that were mummified after their death and paraded around, or people would be displayed in their coffins after they'd been hung, John, where people would pay money to come and look at the corpse, which is one of those weird things that I think we often forget just how close in history that sort of thing went on.
Yes, and then like I couldn't resist getting Billy the Kid in there too, because Billy the Kid wasn't really mummified, but they did allegedly chop off his trigger finger that he'd killed so many people with, and they put it in a jar and like toured it around the United States allegedly. So I had to sneak that in there as well.
It was a strange time for entertainment, in my opinion, John. But
yeah,
you know, it's a long time ago in regards to what would pass for entertainment, but very close in regards to actual historical data. But I have to say, the story that shocked and surprised me the most, I think, in the early part of the book, is this Navajo witch purge that occurred. I'd never heard of any of this, John. Obviously, I was aware of the Trail of Tears and everything that had gone on about the displacement of the Native Americans, and then problems at where they'd been sent, and then they had to come back. To then read about what went on after that and the characters involved, I found absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, so what's even more surprising is that's still a very taboo subject today. And I mean, we won't get in trouble for it over in Great Britain, but like I submitted that story in a shortened form to the local paper, because a lot of those chapters that appear in those books also run in our local paper too. And they wouldn't take that one because they said, well, it's still too taboo. And actually, Native American people won't even say the word skinwalker out loud. And a lot of other local people as well won't say it out loud, especially not after dark. It's like a real thing. It's like an actual scene from one of the old Universal horror movies, you know, where the lady gives Jonathan Harker the cross and says, wear it for your mother's sake. The skinwalker thing around here is just like that even today. But yeah, so for people unfamiliar, skinwalkers, you know, they're basically Native American werewolves. How they induce the transformation is they put on whatever animal skin they want to turn into. You know, it's not like they get bitten by something or anything like that. You know, it's they're in control of the transformation. And, you know, so it's basically whatever animal skin they want to wear is whatever creature they'll turn into. But so back in 1878, the Navajos had been very unjustly sequestered in Fort Sumner, New Mexico, which really was not a good spot for them. The land just wasn't a good spot to farm or try to live a life. So it was such a failed experiment that they allowed the Navajo to return to Arizona. And they were just in a really bad state after enduring, you know, the long walk to New Mexico and the long walk back to Arizona. And they either suffered attacks from actual Navajo witches, or they just blamed their misfortune on Navajo witches. You know, it's tough to say what the truth is, but whatever the truth, it was kind of like the Spanish Inquisition. I believe about 40 different Navajos were accused of witchcraft and executed, and it got to the point that the U.S. military had to intervene and put a stop to it, because the accusations were just getting so out of control. And I'm sure that a few of them probably were actual witches who had, you know, committed some evil deed, but the rest of them were probably just people that someone didn't like, and they realized, well, if I accuse them of being a witch, they're going to get executed and I don't have to deal with them anymore. That's probably what the bulk of it was.
I noticed it was quite interesting. It was, for me, an excellent comparison that you looked at what went on in Salem, because it clearly was a lot of that going on, as you say, because some of these people were happy with the land that they'd been given, and some of their neighbours seemed to be prospering a lot more than they were, John, and therefore they were sort of, rather than dealing with the hand that they'd been dealt with, they then came up with these trumped up accusations that these people were using witchcraft to grow crops, which for many of us, like we say, we're talking about an incident that happened under 150 years ago, which would surprise a lot of people regardless, I think.
Yeah, and it got off to a really wild start. The start of the whole incident was they dug up a corpse, and somehow or another inside the corpse's stomach, which was split open, was the treaty between the Navajo and the U.S. military. And it's like, so it kind of reminds me of something from that movie Seven or yes, something with, you know, a crazy serial killer. You know, it's just weird, but it allegedly really happened.
Yeah, it's it is one of those aspects as well, like you say, that it seemed to be absolutely running out of control until there's like a local trader who's got a reputation for being a friend of all communities that seems to be the sort of central character in all this, that he did somebody, does somebody get murdered in his doorway of his trading post or something? And it's that's where everybody said, oh, well, we can't come to your store anymore because now it's cursed.
Yeah, that's precisely right.
So what was it about that? Was it this, was it a case of that then the whole environment became cursed by the spirit of who had been murdered there, John? Was that how they kind of saw what would happen, that these alleged witches would sort of transfer their spirit to the surroundings?
So from what I understand about the Navajo culture is any place a person dies, well, if they die naturally, it's different. But if a person is murdered in a violent way, it's kind of like that spot is cursed, and they probably have to have a medicine man do a ceremony or something. So the one who got murdered at the store was an accused witch, but it did really matter. I mean, any person who had been murdered there in that way would have made them react the same way, and they just would never go to that spot again, apparently.
Yeah. It is interesting when you mention in the book that obviously this store owner is the gentleman that basically says, we need the army here. And I found that quite surprising that as soon as the military turn up, they seem to just really sort of tail away almost immediately. And you were saying that there were sporadic murders that were still going on, but it really sort of quelled it as more than it needed, I think, far quicker, because God knows what would have happened if it had been allowed to carry on.
Yes, and I feel like we definitely miss a lot of the story. And I think we were probably fortunate to get what we did out of it, because the Navajos just won't talk about skinwalkers at all. I mean, that we even have that much of the history is really pretty remarkable.
It's surprising as well, because once again, as we were saying about when you say the word mummy, you think Egypt. I think these days, if you say anything to do with skinwalker, you primarily think, well, this is Utah then.
Yeah. And what's so funny about that skinwalker ranch is there's really not a lot of skinwalkers on it. It's more UFOs. And in terms of like the wolves, what I read about was these giant wolves that they would sight that kind of sound like prehistoric dire wolves or something. But I mean, supposedly people in the area see skinwalkers running along the sides of their cars. But like on the ranch itself, though, the family that had the ranch, that I didn't really get the impression they saw skinwalkers all that much. It was kind of a name that other people attributed to the ranch, but mostly it was just like UFOs and balls of light and things like that.
Yeah, it is surprising. I was very surprised to hear you say that for the Navajo, they have the same kind of fear of the word that certain tribes in the north of the US and Canada have when it comes to the Wendigo, that they don't even want to mention the word.
Yeah.
Is it that same kind of fear that they think if they mention it, they'll get visited, or it will encourage skinwalkers to return to the area, perhaps, John?
Yes, precisely.
And I suppose people would be surprised to hear that people still think that, but yet if you look at native cultures, they are steeped in history and things being passed down. So I think when you get a bigger understanding of the way tribes look at their history and their cultures and their beliefs, it's not surprising that still, do you think it still lurks in the shadows, this fear of these creatures?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's certain villages here in New Mexico where it's, you know, some of the inhabitants really believe they've seen the mischievous little people called Los Duendes. You know, they really believe in the mischievous dwarves and claim they can see them, you know, even today. So it's, you know, it's wild.
I think, as I was saying about the surprising number of vampire stories in the book, like it would be unfair of me not to touch on this one. This story about this vampire chair.
Yeah.
It's one of those that it's quite a sad story, because obviously we've got a murder, but it's one of those that seems to have a lot of cross-continental history to it, because you've got crossroads and people being buried face down, which are traditionally European traditions. So these were clearly things that came with people who'd moved from Europe to to the west then, John?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And there's also, in addition to the vampire chair, there's a vampire quilt from the same area. And I just didn't quite fit it into the book. But
and you have a vampire tree.
Yeah, vampire tree. Though that, you know, that intrigued me the most. And I wanted so bad to find an European folklore where if you put a stake through the vampire's heart, a tree will grow out of it. And I found that nowhere in European folklore. So it seems to be something that people here in North America and Central America, I guess, made up, because they also have a vampire tree in Mexico, which is the same type of story, stake through the heart, tree grew out of it. And I just didn't put it in this particular book, but it'll be in the next one, just on vampires.
Yeah. I mean, that is surprising because, as we say, these are the kind of things you would primarily say these are Eastern European beliefs. And yet when you see these areas, it's not beyond the realms of comprehension, John, that you would have large populations of people from Eastern Europe moving to the US at that period. But it seems very odd that you'd have that kind of belief turning up in Mexico, which, as we were saying at the beginning, once again, this is showing that regardless of people's knowledge and connection to each other, they had very similar beliefs about such creatures.
Yeah, I'm glad you're giving me an excuse to talk about something I wanted to. I was on a podcast last night about vampires, and I never really got to get in depth about these vampire witches from Mexico. But in the mid-1950s, in a very rural spot of Mexico called Tlaxcala, it's like smack dab in the middle of Mexico, very rural. The Mexican government noticed they kept getting all of these death certificates for babies, and they were all marks of cause of death sucked by the witch, like they had been drained of blood by a vampire in the night. And they literally got so many of these death certificates that they made like an official investigation into that area.
Mm.
And but the vampires, it's very hard to pronounce. It's something like Telepuche. It's so hard to pronounce. I shouldn't even try, but there are these mostly female vampires that the people claimed would come in the middle of the night. And when they would find their babies dead in the morning, they would always blame them on these female vampires. And the belief in them was very real. So it's just, even into the mid-1950s, you know, there were people who truly believed in vampires.
I mean, it is something that keeps popping up because obviously there was a big furore here in Europe about 20, 30 years ago where there was a case of an alleged vampire reappearing in Romania, and that caused shockwaves all across Europe because it ended up that they'd dug a corpse up and burnt its heart and eaten it, which a lot of people were like, what on earth are these people? And it was remarkable when I think Josh Gates actually went out there to speak to somebody, and they took him out there, and they were so entrenched in this belief, even in the late 20th century, John, that I think people sometimes forget just how powerful these beliefs can be wherever you are in the world.
Yeah. And, you know, you talking about eating the heart and all that, you know, that's something that people should find interesting is, you know, it's not at all like they make it appear in the old Hammer movies, which I love, but like the way you defeat the vampire or any of that stuff is so weird because, like you said, they believed in exhuming the heart from the vampire and you'd burn it and then you'd drink the ashes and that would cure the person who got bit by the vampire. Or this one's really silly. This one applied to those vampires from Mexico. How you would immobilize them was to take off your pants, turn one leg inside out and throw the pants on the ground. And for whatever silly reason, that would immobilize the vampire. So, I mean, it's not like the movies at all.
Well, it's one of those things. The more I've done this show, the more I've learned about some of these strange ways of dealing with weird creatures, John. I know in Eastern Europe, they would take coins with them if there was a vampire, because vampires are allegedly in certain areas obsessed with counting. So if you throw the coins on the ground, you can escape because the vampire will be too busy counting.
Oh, is that where the count from Sesame Street comes from? I mean, no joke. Maybe that's where they got the idea because he counts. I don't know.
Yeah, that is my theory. I did a show a couple of years ago about vampires, and that was entirely my theory, John. So great minds think alike. I think somebody involved in Sesame Street must have been from Eastern Europe because I find it odd you would have a vampire character whose obsession is counting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, not just because he's called the Count. I think that's a bit too obvious for me. I think there's more to it than meets the eye. I mean, the other aspect of some of these stories is, once again, when we're talking about creatures you perhaps wouldn't expect, and as we were talking about skinwalkers, it's werewolves, John, because I think these days, a lot of it all seems to be coming together where you've got skinwalkers, dogman, werewolves, and they seem to be a very interchangeable thing. But you've got a couple of stories where people were clearly talking about werewolves, not dogmen, and not skinwalkers.
Yeah. Oh, I was on the podcast last night, the same one that I talked about the vampires on, but we talked about the land between lakes in Kentucky, where they have a rash of werewolf sightings. And there's a lady on the show that named Robin McCrae that's a real expert on that stuff, and she had mentioned that cryptids and strange beings like dogmen look for isolated areas to get away from people so they can remain hidden. And that's why when people go camping in those areas, you know, they sometimes meet a grisly end, because those things want to be left alone, and that's where they run to. And it's true, though, that there's a remarkable amount of disappearances in the state parks across the United States. There's just it's very eyebrow raising.
Yes, that is the kind of subject that runs chills up my spine, because it is. I know people say these state parks in the US are vast expanses of land, and people might fall off places and fall down crevices and into caves with no bottom, and places that may have simply just become overgrown and disappear. And yet, there's a lot of them where there's some strange things going on, and people go out with friends and their friends just vanish. Some of it just doesn't make sense. Do you have any kind of incidents or areas like that in the sort of southern US where you've got these kind of areas where people just vanish off the face of the earth, John?
Well, gosh, I know there's got to be. Well, Skinwalker Ranch is one. They claim that it, if you walk into the wrong spot, you can kind of walk into another dimension and disappear and never be seen again.
Mm-hmm.
And then your Raca Mesa here in New Mexico, I think is the real life inspiration behind the mesa that we saw in the Ghostbusters movie last year, Afterlife. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's the real inspiration for that.
Yeah. I know the Grand Canyon seems to, as we were saying about strange lost lands that have survived from the prehistoric era, there are alleged areas in there where people have just disappeared off the face of the earth as though they've walked into a portal or something.
Yes. And I'm also in my mummies, the book that's just going to be mummies, I'm definitely going to walk up or write about that Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon they say exists.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is a very strange story. Well, I think before I let you go, there's one other story that really made my eyebrows raise. And this is this alleged phantom that plagued Jesse James and his gang, which is one of those stories that I've never really heard about. Obviously, everybody knows about the James gang and Jesse and Frank James and their hobbies at that period of time, John. But this is a very odd story because it's almost like it's a portent. It's a very old-fashioned story in regards to this something's chasing these people. So what's all this about, and how did you come across this one?
So for that one, I want to give credit to the one who rediscovered it. And my memory can be really dangerous, but I'm pretty positive it's Adam Benedict.
Yes.
Have you seen his books? So I'm right, right? It's Adam Benedict?
Yeah. Adam's been on a couple of times.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that came from his book Ghosts in Print recently. And I lifted it out of there, we occasionally swap little, we try to help each other out. Like, and then me and Dave Weatherly will do that. Like, he'll send me his old newspaper articles he's found. I'll send whatever he's working on, which state for that book. But yeah, so that one came from Adam. He found that. I would have never known it existed if it wasn't for him. And I basically stayed away from ghost stories in this particular book, unless it was a really cool story like that, which involved someone as famous as Jesse James. So it was just a must. But I cannot find anything else about Jesse James and the Phantom other than that one article. And I really wish I could find more corroboration on it. So it's definitely quite an interesting little tale.
Yeah, it was one of the aspects of some of these stories that you mention in this particular book is that some of these characters from the Wild West, there seems to be this kind of supernatural power attached to them. I know you mentioned one particular story about when Billy the Kid died and people claimed, I know it's one particular article, I think, John, that you could smell brimstone and the devil turned up to take his soul back to hell.
Yeah, so funny. I mean, clearly they're just making it up, but it's just they had that fascination.
Is there a lot of aspects of these stories when they're dealing with these characters? Because, yeah, there are some very odd aspects to some of these famous outlaws from that period. Is this something that tended to be attributed to them primarily by the newspapers trying to explain away why these people were so bad?
I think, yeah, it was absolutely just the newspapers, because Billy the Kid was really pretty popular with the people who actually knew him, you know, the little people, quote unquote, you know, as opposed to the rich, you know, land barons and all that. So he was very well liked, and Jesse James was well liked among some people, and others say he really was just, you know, kind of a crook. So that's the thing about history is, it's so hard to tell if you can't see it for yourself. You just have to go on what the old timers said. And a lot of times the old timers contradict each other. So it's really frustrating.
Yes. The problems of memory and time, I think, John.
Yeah.
Do many other of these Western characters have ghost stories attributed to them? Because there's a lot of people that claim to see ghosts of such characters or make contact with them in this modern era, where it seems every location in every aspect of the world is now haunted by somebody famous.
I looked really hard for some of the other ones, like Calamity Jane or Wild Bill Hickok, and I just didn't see any interesting stories like I did with Jesse James and Billy the Kid. I'm sure they're out there, and I just missed them. But I just didn't see any. But so Billy and Jesse and that Black Jack Ketchum were the only really interesting ones that I found.
Yeah, well, that Black Jack story is extremely gruesome.
Yeah.
And shows the dangers of arranging a hanging in a town that's never had one before.
Yes.
Was that a common incident in hangings in those days? Or is that one of the reasons you chose that story, that it's one of the best examples of somebody's head coming off during a hanging?
Yeah, that was the main reason I chose that story. I mean, and then the basis of the chapter is they saw his ghost at Uraca Mesa a little bit later. But yeah, I mean, yeah, the head getting ripped off in the hanging. If that was all that happened, I wouldn't have included it, because nothing supernatural about it. But, you know, it's just his ghost was seen later on. So that you know, helped me get it in the book.
Yeah. And also, once again, as we were talking about the displaying of corpses, that people went to see the body without the head, and then they thought, oh, well, hang on a minute, let's stitch his head back on.
And you would think, if you were a smart newspaper writer, you would hoax a story about the headless ghost of Black Jack Ketchum, but nobody's ever done it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of odd.
Yeah. I was expecting that to actually be the punchline. So I was quite surprised that aspect of that hoax wasn't there. For me, it seems like perfect newspaper fodder for that period.
Yeah, me too.
Well, John, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, and your new book is full of these wonderful stories. I recommend them highly. So where can everybody track down your work and get hold of a copy of this book and also your wonderful previous editions covering all kinds of weird things?
Yeah, so the easiest way is, you know, it doesn't matter what country you live in, just get on all Amazon.com and type in John LeMay under books, and that's LEMAY. And, you know, what'll happen is one of my books will pop up. If you click on it, you can click on my author page and just all of them will come up, because I've got books on film history, more cryptozoology stuff, just basic Billy the Kid history stuff. And then I just did a novel about the theft of Billy the Kid's tombstone called The Noted Desperado Pancho Dumez. And that's my most recent book. So that's the newest one.
Hmm. Is Billy the Kid one of the characters that seems to have so much go on with his tomb? Because I know there's all kinds of stuff that people just kept stealing in.
Yes. In fact, a man wrote an entire book just about Billy the Kid's gravesite. There's literally, and it's not like stretching it either. It's there is plenty to talk about when it comes to his grave. It's really wild.
So what's next for you, John? What's the next subject you're going to be releasing to the public?
Yeah, well, as I said, around this coming fall, I'm hoping I'll have all three books done at once that kind of spin off of Cowboys and Monsters. So again, that'll be tentatively it's titled Cowboys and Vampires. One of them I think I'm going to call Cowboys and Dogmen. And then the last one I'll probably call like Mummies of the Americas or something like that. But hopefully all three of those will be out.
Fabulous. Well, I look forward to those, and hopefully we may get a chance to speak about one or if not all of them at some point in the future. John, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure to finally speak with you, and I wish you the very best for the rest of the year.
Thank you, and I would love to come back anytime.